I want to, first of all, express my appreciation to the eldership here and to the School of Preaching for the invitation extended to me to speak on the lectureship. The theme of this lectureship, Christian Evidences, is one that's very near and dear to my heart. Ever since I started college at Ohio Valley College under the instruction of Brother Tom Gommer, he piqued an interest in my concern with Christian Evidences, and then, of course, through Brother Thomas Warren at Harding Graduate School, I had the privilege of getting my master's degree in that particular field. I do feel a challenge this morning to have to deal with a subject that took a doctor's dissertation that Brother Warren wrote at Vanderbilt University to deal with. And I have about 40 minutes to compress some of that, and we'll do the best we can along this line. It is a difficult subject. Answering atheism's argument, that is the answer to the atheistic argument of evil and suffering, which they say proves that there is no God. Perhaps no argument from atheism has been used with greater frequency and force than this one particular argument. But I think we need to understand that this particular argument is not a new argument that has just come down the pike over the last 20 or 30 years. For example, the Greek philosopher Epicurus is quoted by Lactantius, who is a 4th century apologist, and this is found in the writings of the Ante-Nicene Fathers. Lactantius wrote a treatise on the anger of God and quotes the Greek philosopher Epicurus as saying, God either wishes to take evils and is unable, or He is able and unwilling, or He is neither willing nor able, or He is both willing and able. If He is willing and unable, He is feeble, which is not according to the character of God. If He is able and unwilling, He is envious, which is equally at variance with God. If He is neither willing nor able, He is both envious and feeble, and therefore not God. If He is both willing and able, which is alone suitable to God, from what source then are evils, or why does He not remove them? You see from that people have been dealing and struggling with the problem of evil for a long, long time. How can the existence of evil be reconciled with an all-powerful and all-benevolent God? Other philosophers have taken this argument and enlarged and built on it. For example, the British philosopher David Hume had quite a lot to say about this particular argument. And the one that I want to deal with this morning, the one that Brother Thomas Warren dealt with in his study at Vanderbilt, was the one put forth by an Australian philosopher by the name of J.L. Mackey. In its most basic form, the argument takes the following form. Premise number one, God is omnipotent. Premise number two, God is perfect in goodness. And premise number three, evil exists. Now, when you look at those three premises, Professor Mackey said that there is a logical contradiction here. He says that one cannot consistently maintain those three propositions without involving himself in a logical contradiction. However, Mackey himself admits that the contradiction is not immediately evident. And so to make it clear, he adds the following premises. Premise number four, he says, good is opposed to evil in such a way that a good thing always eliminates evil as far as it can. Premise number five, he says, there are no limits to what an omnipotent thing can do. Premise number six, a good, benevolent being eliminates evil completely. And then premise number seven, a good omnipotent thing exists. And then Mackey would conclude, there is a logical contradiction involved in the conjunction of premises seven, a good omnipotent thing exists, and evil exists. So that's how he arrives at his conclusion by adding these extra premises here. And if you're interested in doing some further reading along that line, let me encourage you to purchase Brother Warren's book, Have Atheists Prove There's No God? This book is essentially the last chapter of his doctorate dissertation that I showed you a moment ago. But he sets forth these things here. Now, I would suggest that if you are a theist, that is a believer in God and a Christian, you have no hesitancy in affirming Proposition 1, that God is omnipotent, or Proposition 2, that God is perfect in goodness. But we would deny that there is a logical contradiction in affirming Proposition 3, that evil exists. Now, due to the limitations of time, I'm going to concentrate on two responses to Professor Mackey's argument here. One point of attack to Mackey's argument is to deny one of his propositions. And I'm going to deny Proposition 5, which he says, there are no limits to what an omnipotent thing can do. Now, you may be thinking, wait a minute. That's not right. If God is omnipotent, he can do anything. Well, let me share with you some things that I believe will deny that proposition. Because if we can show that that proposition, there are no limits to what an omnipotent thing can do, is false, then Mackey's argument falls by the wayside. Let me suggest to you that God's omnipotence relates to what is possible to be done. God cannot do that which is in opposition to his perfection in goodness and justice. For example, we all know, and the Bible affirms, that it is impossible for God to lie. Well, there's one thing an omnipotent thing can't do. It is impossible for God to lie, because that contradicts his very being. It contradicts the fact that he is perfect in goodness and justice. To say that God is omnipotent is to say that God can do what is subject to be done, and that in harmony with his nature. For example, and you hear some of these things quoted and said by an atheist, some things that omnipotent power cannot do. The question, could God make a rock so big he couldn't lift it? No. Can God make a four-sided triangle? Well, we know that by definition a triangle has three sides. Could God make a three-sided square? Well, again, we know by definition a square has four equal sides. Could God make an object white all over and black all over at the same time? Or could God cause an object to be and not be at the same time? Well, obviously, we are dealing with things that cannot be done at all. Not even omnipotent power can do these things. I'd like to give you a statement made by Brother Warren, which I think will help explain this. In his book, he said, God is infinite in power. But power meaningfully relates only to what can be done, to what is possible of accomplishment, not to what is impossible. It is absurd to speak of any power, even infinite power, being able, that is, having the power, to do what simply cannot be done. God can do whatever is possible to be done, but he will do what is in harmony with his nature. I believe then that Mackey's proposition that there are no limits to what an omnipotent thing can do is simply false. And thus his argument fails. also related to this proposition of Mackey's is the argument that some have proposed in the atheistic field that God could create persons who would always freely choose to do good and never commit a single act of sin. The philosopher John Hick pointed out that there would be a contradiction in holding that God made us so that we shall of necessity act in a certain way and that we are a genuinely independent person in relation to God. In other words, God could make us so that we would have free will, but we would only have free will to do what's right. Well, that isn't free will. Most of us have a computer, and they're programmed. If you press a certain button, certain things happen. Can we say that that computer is acting out of its free will? Absolutely not. Is that what human beings are? Are we like the computer? God did create us with free will. That is, the ability to choose our actions, to choose our activities, and consequently, to suffer the consequences of those choices. We are either free or not free. We cannot both be free and not free. That is a contradiction. So God cannot make us with the ability to do a choice and then say, oh, by the way, you're only restricted to making this choice. Then we're really not free. When we press a certain button, that computer has no option except to blow up to carry out what we have programmed it to do. But you know, God did not program us to act in a certain way. He wants us to act in a certain way, but He has given us the power and the freedom of choice. And human beings sometimes make the wrong choices. And we suffer the consequences of those wrong choices. God could create a puppet robot-like creature who would always act in certain ways. But again, as Dr. Warren said, it is logically impossible for God to guarantee that His creatures who are free will always, that is, without even one exception, freely choose to love and trust Him. It is logically impossible for such beings to be created, and since this is the case, it is not a denial of the omnipotence of God to hold that men are at times guilty of failing to love, trust, and obey God. And I think every one of us realizes and acknowledges that. We have a choice. And the reason we have a choice is that God made us creatures of choice. We can choose to do that which is good, or we can choose to do that which is evil. And then another statement that I would like to read. It is a contradiction to affirm that it is possible to create an intelligent, true moral agent and then place him in a situation in which he was beyond all possibility of sinning. No power, not even infinite power, can create a being who is a free moral agent and who is yet beyond even the possibility of sinning. And we really need to grasp that point. It is impossible, even for an omnipotent being, to create a being who is free and not free. Who is free only to do good and not evil. That's an impossibility. And again, that premise then of Mackey, that there are no limits to what an omnipotent thing can do, is a false premise. Both the atheist and the theist affirm that evil exists. While there are some things or some actions which some would call evil, let me hasten to add that sin is the only evil. Sin causes a breakdown in relationship between me and God and me and my brother. That's the only evil. Now, I know we have witnessed these tremendous natural disasters over the past year and a half. Hurricane after hurricane, and tornado after tornado, the tsunami and floods and everything else. And a lot of people would say those are evil. But something inanimate cannot be evil. They may be, to use Dr. Warren's phrase, instrumentally evil, or they may be instrumentally good. The same could be said of pain and suffering. I read a statement where an atheist said that even one instance of pain is enough to prove that God does not exist. That assumes that all pain and all suffering are bad or are evil, that there are no benefits to pain or suffering. Well, we know better than that. And the atheist ought to know better than that. The Bible affirms that sin is the transgression of the will of God. Sin causes us to fall short of what would God have us to do and to be. Evil then becomes the responsibility of man, not God. Since we are made creatures of choice, if I choose to do that which is against the will of God, that's evil. Then I am responsible for that evil. God is not morally culpable for the evil that's in the world today. Man is responsible. Therefore, God cannot be blamed for the existence of evil. Since sin is the only evil, then pain or suffering is not intrinsically evil. And as I mentioned before, it may be instrumentally good, or that which can produce good, or it may be that which can produce evil. For example, an individual may be suffering greatly because, let's say, of cancer or AIDS or some other disease that may be terminal. After all, we're all terminal, aren't we? Now, how that person reacts to that suffering and pain will determine whether or not that suffering and pain may be instrumentally good or instrumentally evil. If my suffering drives me toward God, then it's good. If it drives me away from God, it's evil. And we have examples in the Bible to show that that is the case. Job, for example. Paul, for example. Joseph, for example. And a host of others who suffered a lot of pain and suffering, but they were driven toward God, not away from Him. There are some instances in which pain is good. A doctor may inflict a little pain to remove a gangrenous foot. About 3 years ago, I had 6 heart bypasses done. That was not pleasant. There was some pain and suffering involved in it. But I was not angry at the doctor for inflicting that pain on me. He saved my life. And some of you have had the same experience. Pain is often good because it reveals that something may be wrong in our bodies. Suffering can either draw us toward God, or it can move us away from God. And you know, the time for us to think about how we are going to react to suffering is not when you start to suffer. We need to be giving that some thought right now. Because chances are, every one of us here this morning is going to be involved in some pain and suffering. And sometimes it's going to be intense. And sometimes we may not understand why we're suffering. And it is true that sometimes we suffer because of not anything we did, but because of something somebody else did. As a result of sin and suffering, suffering and or pain came into this world. There are many reasons why we suffer. Sometimes we suffer because of ignorance. A little child picks up a bottle of drain cleaner. He has no idea what it is and drinks it. He still has to suffer the consequences. That's why we try to teach our children, don't run out into the street. According to the atheist, if a child did, God would be responsible for suddenly removing that child. You know, if God intervened every time we hurt ourselves or hurt somebody else, how could we ever learn responsibility? How would we ever know that there are consequences to our actions if God would just intervene every time something like that happened? We live in a law-abiding world. And yet, according to the atheist, God ought to stop those laws from happening if we violate them. If we fall off a 10-story building, we ought not to suffer because of it. If we find ourselves in trouble in a lake, God ought to freeze up the lake so we wouldn't drown. Of course, that would present problems if somebody out there is fishing. You can see how ridiculous this thing can get. We also suffer because of accidents. We also suffer because the world we live in includes natural disasters. And yet, as Brother Warren pointed out in his book, every instance of natural disasters or the things that produce these natural disasters are necessary for this world to be what is called a veil of soul making, where we make our decision for God or not. No one denies that pain and suffering do not come out of these natural disasters. Sometimes we suffer because the sins of others. And then we suffer because of our own sins. Sometimes men have suffered because of the providence of God working in their lives. I think of Joseph. You think it was really fun for Joseph to be in prison? I doubt it. Do you think it was fun for him to be at the bottom of that cistern, not knowing what his brothers were going to do to him? But even Joseph realized at the end it wasn't his brothers that sent him to Egypt. He says, God did it, not you. God had a purpose for all this. We may not always understand what that purpose is. The same with Abraham and Job and Paul and others. Job in particular. Sometimes we don't study that book like we ought to. Maybe we think it's too long. It takes too long to get through it. But here was a man who was righteous, who lived a good, upright life, who was a good influence upon his family, and yet look what that man suffered. And he didn't know why he was suffering. And his three friends tried to get Job to admit that you've done something terrible to cause God to afflict you like this. And for the life of him, Job couldn't think of anything. And yet we know how that story turned out, don't we? Job did not reject God. The Apostle Paul did not reject God. Joseph did not reject God simply because they were suffering, sometimes intensely. As a matter of fact, they were all drawn closer to God. Like Job, we may never know the exact reason why we are suffering. But with the proper knowledge and faith, we can overcome it. While the atheist would deny it, there are some benefits of suffering. These benefits come when we react to suffering as God would have us. Brother Warren also has written a fine little book called Our God, A Sun and Shield for Troubled Hearts. This is the best thing I've ever read on how to deal with suffering. And in his book, Brother Warren sets forth a number of benefits that suffering has. For example, suffering helps the sufferer to know himself. You may think you know who you really are. When times are good and you're pain-free and everything's just going well, you may think you have a pretty good handle on who you are. But get hit with some intense suffering and maybe you begin to doubt who you are. Suffering can help us really know who we are. Secondly, suffering can help the sufferer to attain a proper set of values. You know, when someone is lying in a hospital bed dying, do you really think his thoughts are of all the money he's accumulated, all the power and wealth that he has, or is he more interested in getting his health back? You know, every once in a while on the news, they'll interview a person who has had something tragic happen to him and he's survived it. And invariably they say something like, you know, this has caused me to rethink what's really important in my life. Why do we have to wait till we suffer to do that? But suffering can do that. Suffering can also help the sufferer be thankful for his blessings. You know, the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians talked about momentary light affliction worketh for us an exceeding and eternal weight of glory. We ought to be thankful that suffering is just for a while, and that there are many blessings that we have. Suffering also helps the sufferer to see the value of prayer. The Apostle Paul prayed to God 3 times that God would remove the thorn in the flesh. I don't know exactly what that was. All I know, it must have been pretty painful. But the answer from God came, "My grace is sufficient for thee." And Paul accepted that. Fifth, suffering helps the sufferer to understand what a blessing it is not to be able to see what the future holds. I know sometimes we wish we could, but God in His infinite wisdom has chosen to keep that from us, so that we deal with our existence basically one day at a time. Therefore, the fact that human beings suffer does not prove that God does not exist. There are benefits that can come to us when we suffer. There are many other arguments that we could make, and I would just encourage you, if you want to pursue this further, to take a look at Brother Warren's little book, Have Atheists Prove There's No God? Because he sets forth some other things that he uses to deal with the arguments that J.L. Mackey put forward. And If you are involved in suffering, whether it be emotional, physical, whatever the case may be, I would encourage you to get a copy of Brother Warren's little book, Our God, a Sun and Shield for Troubled Hearts. I believe it can be of tremendous benefit to you. It was, and it has been to me for many, many years along that line. Suffice it to say that the atheist has not made his case that the existence of evil and suffering prove that God does not exist. I'm amazed that an atheist can even speak of evil at all. Because what standard can he use to call something evil or good for that matter? Jesus said, don't you know there's only one who is good? God defines good. You can't really talk about good and evil without, to me, inferring that there's a God. Because if good and evil are nothing but subjective, then what may be good to you may not be good to me. It may be evil and vice versa. So the atheist, to me, is the one who really has the problem. Well, we can know, and part of this lectureship has been to demonstrate that there is a God. And many of the speakers have set forth the various arguments that have been used for centuries to prove the existence of God. Now, Charles Pugh and I were privileged to hear Dr. Warren in two debates with Dr. Anthony Flew, who, by the way, is not an atheist anymore. He believes in some kind of higher supreme power. And if Brother Warren was alive, he'd have been on the first plane over to England to talk to him. We were there at that debate, and the debate that he had with Dr. Wallace Matson, who I think is also deceased, if I'm not mistaken. And Charles and I sat there and watched two of the greatest, most well-known atheists try to deal with atheism, and they couldn't do it. They just couldn't do it. And if they can't, I'm not worried about anybody else doing it either. We ought to be thankful to men who have prepared themselves, like Dr. Warren did, and others, to challenge this kind of thinking. And I appreciate the lectureship committee here for choosing such an important subject as Christian evidences, because we need to know whereof we speak. We need to be able to give a reason for the hope that lies within us, yet with meekness and fear. And Brother Warren so ably did that in those two debates. So kind and so humble that even his opponents were impressed with that. God exists, and we can know it. Let's obey Him and trust Him, because heaven can be our home. Thank you.